The director of the documentary Crum, Terry Zwigoff, has been a friend of Crum's for 25 years. Zwigoff says he first thought of making this film back in 1974 when he met R. Crum's reclusive older brother Charles. R. Crum credits Charles with getting him and the whole family interested in comics. Zwigoff looked beyond Charles' eccentricity and saw brilliance and wit. Terry Zwigoff is also the director of a documentary about blues musician Howard Armstrong called Louie Bluie, and a documentary about Hawaiian music called A Family Named Mo. I spoke with him about his new documentary, Crum. I think what I find fascinating about your film is that it raises a lot of questions about madness and genius. I mean, both R. Crum and his older brother Charles are not what we'd call normal. They're both incredibly talented, but it seems that Charles didn't have the energy or the will to actually work, whereas R. Crum had the drive. In fact, he was obsessive about his work. Did you find yourself thinking a lot during the making of this movie about that combination of madness and genius?
Oh, yeah. I had read a book called Touched with Fire. Forget the woman that wrote it.
Oh, that's a book about manic depressives.
Yeah,
who were
and the
artists.
Correlation between manic depressive illness and creativity. It's a really interesting book. Ran down all these figures in history, famous artists and writers like Melville and Poe and Byron, and how they all had this incredibly high rate of either suicide or being institutionalized. And I don't know, in general, you know, I find most art, whether it's film or painting, anything that stems out of suffering by the artist is generally what I'm attracted to, you know. Like my favorite films are by, you know, people like Scorsese, who, you know, I don't know, he's probably pretty well adjusted now after all his success, but I'm sure when he started out, he's probably a very bitter, twisted guy, and he made very interesting films. He still does, to his credit, but he makes films you don't usually see in Hollywood, you know, films about losers and loners and the disenfranchised, and that's always been of interest to me.
Your film, Crum, opens with R. Crum on the telephone calling up his brother, saying that you want to come over and shoot some scenes there, that you want Charles in the movie.
Right.
And Charles apparently doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to be in the film. What made him change his mind?
Well, what really happened is when I started this film about 1985, I told Robert when he finally agreed to do it that I had no interest in making it unless his brother Charles and his mother and his brother Max and agreed to be in it. And so he said, well, all right, well, let me call my mother and see if she'll do it, because she's probably going to say no. But he called her, and she remembered me, and I had actually hit it off with her pretty good, as I really liked her, and I thought the feeling was mutual when I met her, and ditto with Charles, and they both said yes at the time on the phone. So I told him to tell her that, you know, it would take me a couple months to get it ready, but in a couple months we'd come out their way with a small film crew, and I'd like to spend 4 days at their house filming them. She said, okay. We kept her posted on the dates, and then when we arrived at that motel, you see that scene in the film where he calls her and she says no. She had just completely changed her mind, and I was sort of devastated and, you know, rather shocked, but I spent the next 4 days with the crew sitting around the motel trying to convince her to change her mind back to agree to do the film, and eventually I was able to.
R. Crum's older brother Charles committed suicide shortly after your film was completed. Do you know what happened that put him over the edge?
No, I don't. I don't know what happened at all.
Did you ever worry at all that him being exposed in the film might have upset him or anything?
I worried very much. I had a long talk with Robert about that very subject, whether this film in some way could have contributed to that happening. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know, Robert's opinion was no, that he tried to kill himself a number of times. And, you know, I was worried that possibly that talking about some of these childhood family issues had sort of precipitated things. But then again, when I first met Charles in the early 70s, that's, you know, he talked about exactly the same stuff. So I don't know. It's something I have to sort of deal with for the rest of my life. If it did have anything to do with it, I would feel extremely bad.
You're obviously really absorbed in R. Crum's family, and it's a family of very unusual people. Crum's younger brother is into some kind of unusual approaches to meditation and so on. I mean, he lies on a bed of nails and swallows something that looks like a fabric tapeworm. His mother is very overweight and doesn't seem to even have the strength or the will to sit up on the couch. But you're not parading them as a family of freaks. You seem to just be riveted by them, by their attitude toward life, by what they have to say. What fascinates you about the family and the relationships of the people in it?
I liked his family very much. I when I met them, I felt very close to them. I can't explain why. I felt a deep bond with his family. And I was a little, you know, I've been a little horrified to see now and then in the press somebody describes the family as, you know, in a rather insensitive way, like you were referring to. And I never saw them as that, you know. I always found this very brilliant people, and yeah, a little eccentric, but I really thought they had, I thought they're incredibly interesting to talk to and incredibly funny, and you get to know these people, you find they're very interesting, very likable people.
My guest is Terry Zweigoff, director of the new documentary Crumb, about comic book artist R. Crumb. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Zweigoff, director of the new documentary Crumb. R. Crumb the cartoonist and R. Crumb the man are both sexually obsessed. How did you decide about how you wanted to deal with that in the film?
Well, it was never, you know, I tried in this film to emulate Robert in a sense, in the way he works, and that he sort of goes with his instincts and just sort of tries not to plan, you know, what direction you're going in and trust your instincts and see where that's going to get you. And sometimes you wind up in a dead end and somewhat embarrassed and make a big mistake, and sometimes it's very, very much of a, you get a great payoff out of that. And I never thought about it too much. I just tried to instinctually sort of go along and decide, where's this taking me? Where's this going? What should I, you know, go to next? And it seemed like the two things motivating his art the most and actually fueling him as an artist the most were sex and anger. And, you know, I chose some of his work to show that definitely dealt with both those issues.
You've been Crumb's friend for a long time. Has he expected you to share his sexual obsessions?
No, he's always made fun of my sexual obsessions. I don't know if I have sexual obsessions, but my sexual taste, he's always insinuated that I'm homosexual because I like skinny women, thin women. And I've always sort of told him that I always thought, since he likes muscular women, that that would seem to be more indicative of that in his case. But, you know, this is beginning to sound like some episode of Seinfeld or something where, oh, there's nothing wrong in being gay, of course.
Not
that there's anything wrong with that. But, yeah, I know we sort of joke about it. But we certainly have never, I don't think our taste has ever overlapped in what we find attractive in the opposite sex, that's for sure.
Was he ever embarrassing to be around? Did he ever do anything that was very embarrassing to you?
I was driving him somewhere in my car in San Francisco years ago, and this is the first time I really realized how sexually twisted he was and how obsessed. We're driving down the street, and he saw this woman. Well, I didn't know he saw a woman. I just noticed that he was sort of craning around in his seat and sticking his head out the window to try to see what we had just passed. And he was incredibly animated about it, just going crazy. I said, "What? What?" And I turn around, and there was this woman who was walking down the street who was, I don't know what the correct word is, but, you know, a pinhead, had a very small head.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incredibly excited over her, incredibly excited, just, you know, thought that was the most attractive thing he'd ever seen on a woman. I thought, God, that's pretty strange, pretty strange.
Did he whistle or anything?
No, he was upset for the rest of the day. He was depressed for the rest of the day because he lusted after her so much, he knew he'd never be able to meet her.
I find it very hard to interview friends because when you're interviewing somebody, you really want them to reveal things. When you're interviewing a friend, you know their strengths and weaknesses. You want to protect their weaknesses.
Them, yeah.
And if they tell you things that are very personal, you almost want to say, "You sure you want to say that on tape?" You know.
There are many things I left on the editing room floor in this film.
To protect Crumb?
Well, to protect his family, certainly. There were a lot of things said, say, by Charles, you know, or his mother, that I just thought are nobody's business and has no relevance in this film.
It must have been hard, though, for you to figure out where that line ought to be.
People always said, you know, how can you do that? It's such a thin line to tread. I never had a problem with that. I felt very decided one way or another immediately when something, you know, I looked at something in the editing room, whether this was appropriate or not. It always seemed very easy for me to make that choice. I don't know why. Other things were certainly a lot harder.
How did you meet Crumb?
I was involved, I had met a couple documentary filmmakers in San Francisco when I first moved there. And they were working on a documentary film about animal abuse. I forget what it was called, actually, but they had assembled this work in progress that I was over there for dinner one night. They had the flatbed in their living room, and I said, "Oh, what are you working on?" So we're working on this animal rights documentary, and I said, "Oh, really? Well, I'd like to see it." And they showed it to me. It was just horrifying. The footage was just so gruesome. I mean, I'm haunted to this day by some of the stuff I saw in there. It was a very powerful film, though, you know, and I felt somewhat radicalized politically from seeing it. And I, you know, of course, it was one of the first times that I saw, okay, gee, film is a pretty powerful medium here, huh? It's interesting. But at the same time, more specifically, I thought, I saw in the later months they were having a lot of trouble getting anybody to even come see this film when it was done. And one of the reasons was it was too unpleasant to sit through. And I had the idea to do a comic book about the same issues that would be more metaphorical. And I contacted some other cartoonists whose work I liked, like Art Spiegelman. And he actually contributed this, you know, 4-page comic strip that was called Mouse at the time. It was the entire Mouse book condensed to 4 pages. And it was a very early rendition of what he later developed and refined. And it wasn't very good. I remember looking at it thinking, huh, the cats are Nazis, the mice are Jews. Boy, that's pretty lame, you know. And I almost didn't print it, you know, very brilliant as a publisher back then.
Wow.
But it actually wasn't too good back then, in my defense.
I'll point out for our listeners who don't know, it went on to win a Pulitzer Prize after it was fully formed. And it's a fantastic work.
Oh, it's a great book. Yeah, and the version he turned in wasn't all that great at that time.
So Crumb did something good for
you.
Yeah,
I met Crumb and I asked him to do something for this book. And his initial response was, oh, you want to do a Be Kind to Animals comic, huh? You know, a complete ridicule. But he actually warmed up to the subject and, you know, I made him more informed about, you know, I gave him some of the literature and showed him some of this film and he eventually warmed up to it and he did a cover and a story to this comic, which eventually was published and called Funny Aminals Comics.
Oh.
It's a rare collector's item today. And it didn't have much to do with my original intention. These underground cartoonists were so used to this drawing whatever they wanted that, you know, they generally worked with this theme of animals, but it sure didn't have much to do with what I originally asked them to do, and it was somewhat of a disappointment to me.
Now, did Crumb's comics mean a lot to you?
I liked his work a lot. You know, I'd seen it in college and read it and always enjoyed it. I always thought he was a really great cartoonist, but it never, you know, I didn't really think he was a great artist until much later, until I got to know him. I hung out with him for a while, and he actually changed the way that I see the world.
How so?
Well, the one incident I can remember is coming home from work one day, and he had a key to my house. He was staying at my house for a week, and he had lost the key, and he was locked out. And to pass the time, he was drawing a sketch of this house across the street from me up on the corner, this house that I'd seen, you know, 10,000 times since I'd lived there. And I looked at the sketch he did, and I looked back at the house. I never saw that same scene the same again. He had slightly exaggerated the number of overhead telephone wires and electrical junction boxes and all that junk, you know, and that stuff had always been invisible to me. And that's all he sees in the world, you know. He's almost like this person from another planet, you know. He's always looking for a weakness or something critical to get at, you know, and it's very informative hanging out with the guy. I can't say I'm a happier person from the way I feel much more aware, though, of what's going on in the world.
So what is Crumb's reaction to your movie? Do you know?
He saw it a couple weeks ago on videotape. I asked him to wait and see it on film, but he's very insistent. And finally, I sent him a video, and he is very upset with it. I don't know exactly why. I'm going to talk with him next month. His reaction, what he said to me was, it was excruciating from start to finish. It's so embarrassing, and I had to take a walk in the woods after seeing it to clear my head. So I took my hat off, my favorite hat I've had for 20 years, and I threw it off a cliff, and I decided I don't want to be R. Crumb anymore. And I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You think
sure
he started
I'll
to see himself
out
as a persona after seeing himself in the film?
I don't know. I guess I'll find out.
You know, it's funny, our critic who reviewed your film, Ken Tucker, said that you were free to explore the profound misogyny and self-loathing in Crumb's work because Crumb doesn't care what we end up thinking about him. Maybe he does care.
Oh, he cares. I think, you know, the main reason he had that reaction to the film is he realized that although makes a big show of being very frank and honest in his own comics, he ultimately controls what he does reveal and how it is revealed and how he presents himself. And he draws the line at certain places that I didn't, and he wasn't comfortable with that. And it's, you know, completely understandable.
Do you think this is going to affect your friendship?
I hope not. I can't tell yet. I can't tell.
I thought I'd end our interview with a recording that you made back in the 70s, I guess.
Oh, God.
With R. Crumb and the Cheap Suit Serenaders. And this was a band led by Crumb that played early jazz and some blues and pop from mostly the 20s and 30s.
Pretty much, late 20s, early 30s. We mainly played the stuff on string instruments, though. None of us could play horns or reeds, so... You know, like the mandolin would take a clarinet part and the steel guitar would take a trombone part, that sort of thing. Sort of a novelty band.
How'd you start playing?
I started playing because I had this interest in the music itself. I mean, my favorite music was stuff like, you know, Bix Beiderbecke, Louis Armstrong, music of that period, Jelly Roll Morton. And I had a good collection of it on old 78s. And so did these other guys in the band, Bob Armstrong, Al Dodge, Robert Crumb. And we were all friends. And at some point, we all started imitating, you know, trying to do our own versions of this music, which was, you know, none of us are very good musicians, but we really were sincerely fans of this stuff, so we did our best.
And you'll be playing together, you told me before.
We're going to be on the Garrison Keillor Show June 3rd.
Well, that should be fun. Hopefully you and Crumb will be talking to each other and you'll be on good terms for the reunion.
I hope so. It'll be strange if not.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Terry Zweigoff directed the new documentary, Crumb. It opens this Friday in New York and will open in cities around the country over the next few months. Zweigoff and Crumb will reunite in the band R. Crumb and the Cheap Suit Serenaders June 3rd for a live performance on A Prairie Home Companion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.